All right. My name is Amanda. I have a continuing love-hate relationship with the spiritual forces in the universe. And I'm here because of severe emotional and sexual abuse, anger management, codependency, fear, a complete inability to trust people, and I self-medicate with food. I think in the world we live in today, especially while we're surrounded by so much tragedy and complete uncertainty of what we might wake up to on the front page tomorrow, that it would be beneficial for us to have a conversation about forgiveness. And while I was in the process of writing this out, I found out that there was another shooting today at a church in San Antonio. So to start off tonight, I would like to give you just a brief background of my own story and what role forgiveness has played in my life. I'm 27 years old, and for as long as I can remember, I've always felt different and I've always felt unwanted. I lived in a somewhat dysfunctional household with two parents who hated each other for years and left me and my sister very emotionally neglected. I developed anxiety as early as kindergarten, and by the time I turned 18, I had already attempted suicide and had been through therapy, and the soon-to-be over decade-long process of diagnosis and at least 20 different medications. And I'm now happy to say that the only medications I need now are for my thyroid disease and also just, you know, when I get sick. Starting when I was a teenager, I don't remember the exact year, honestly, like probably 15, through, well, now, because I'm a woman, I've experienced sexual harassment, unwanted forced contact, abusive relationships, just continuous patterns of emotional and sexual abuse in relationships with boyfriends and male friends, mostly. When I was 25, it was determined that I am high-functioning autistic. I finished college in 2013, and in August of this year, I started my master's degree, which I hope I will finish in December of 2018. I am training to be a counselor who specializes in trauma therapy for women and children who have been victimized by some of the same things that I've experienced. There are a lot of reasons why I could be an angry, hateful, bitter person. And I'm not saying I don't still struggle with these things, but by choosing to forgive the people who hurt me and also undertaking the extremely painful work of forgiving myself, I have given myself the freedom to live a life where I am no longer burdened by how those people chose to see me. Whereas they might have seen a weak, easy target or someone they figured they could use and toss aside at their leisure, someone who was quote unquote asking for it, I know and God knows that I am none of those things. Forgiveness is the knowledge that you are bigger than the circumstances you have been thrown into. Forgiveness is not about the people who hurt you. Forgiveness is no longer allowing the people who hurt you to own you, your actions, or to have a hand in writing your story. When you forgive, you are setting yourself free. I think the church and society at large try to show us a false picture of what forgiveness involves. You see it in movies and TV shows that two people who have held grudges against each other for years and years suddenly have this big face-to-face meeting, and there's tears and snot and hugs and rainbows and happily ever after. This is not the case in reality. For most people, including myself, forgiveness is not an instantaneous act. You don't just magically say, I forgive you, and all your animosity disappears. Maya Angelou, who herself was also a victim of sexual abuse, said, I've learned that people will forget what you said, forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. For most of us, we have to choose forgiveness as a daily act. Sometimes what has been done to us is so traumatic we can't even speak it. Forgiveness does not require words. Every person I have forgiven in my life never heard the words, "I forgive you." There was no emotional speech or hug. Those people never knew, but I did. Deep down inside, like I said before, it's not about them, it's about you. We also live in a world that loves to hold grudges and anger. So often we see forgiveness as a weakness. We think that by forgiving someone who caused us pain, we are empowering their behavior in some way. But that actually couldn't be further from the truth. Holding on to anger is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. Buddhist philosopher, and I'm going to butcher this name, I'm sorry, Thich Nhat Hanh said, "When another person makes you suffer, it is because he suffers deeply within himself and his suffering is spilling over." As we say around here, hurt people hurt people. I would also issue you just a word of caution over having forgiveness or the idea of forgiveness forced on you. If you have been hurt and you turn to someone, especially a pastor or somebody in the church, who turns around and says you have to immediately forgive that person or you have to stay with that person because of the Bible, run. That is not true forgiveness. That is manipulation and abuse. Abusers will pull this card so that they can continue hurting you. Anne Lamott, one of my favorite authors, has a couple of quotes that I enjoy about forgiveness. "Forgiveness is giving up all hope of having a better past." I thought such awful thoughts that I cannot even say them out loud because they would make Jesus want to drink gin straight out of the cat dish. I thought such awful thoughts that I cannot even say them out loud because they would make Jesus want to drink gin straight out of the cat dish. I wrote this while I was sitting outside at Spencer's earlier, and I laughed so hard, I'm pretty sure the people at the other table thought I was nuts. Okay, so I would like to close up my talk by sharing a story that I think kind of drives all of this home. It's a video, and it's about 15 minutes long, and I saw it on Facebook several months ago. It is by a Holocaust survivor named Eva Kaur. Some of you may be familiar with her story already. But I think it really hammers in the point of what forgiveness does for you. Not necessarily for another person, although in this case, it did help another person, but what it does for you personally. So I'm going to let Alex start that video for you.
I was born in 1934, one of a pair of twins. Miriam and I were the third and fourth children in the family. We lived in a very small village in Transylvania, Romania. We got down from the cattle car. People were selected to live or to die. People crying, pushing, shoving, dogs barking, trying to make some sense of that place. And I actually turned around in trying to figure out what is that place. Never seen a place like that before. And as I turned around, I realized that my father and my two older sisters were gone. never saw them again. We were holding on to mother for dear life. A Nazi was running in the middle of that selection platform, yelling in German, "Twins, twins." He noticed us and demanded to know if we were twins. And my mother asked, "Is that good?" And the Nazi said, "Yes." My mother said, "Yes." At that moment, another Nazi came, pulled my mother to the right. We were pulled to the left. We were crying. She was crying. And all I ever remember is seeing my mother's arms stretched out in despair as she was pulled away. I never even said goodbye to her, but I did not understand that this would be the last time that we would see her. And all that took, 30 minutes from the time we got down from the cattle car and my whole family was gone, only Miriam and I were left holding hands and crying. We were Mengele twins, which we found out later on what that meant. Mengele would count us every morning, and he wanted to know how many guinea pigs he had this day. I was used in two types of experiments. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, they would put me naked in a room with my twin sister and many other twins up to 8 hours a day. They would measure every part of my body, compare it to my twin sister, and then compare it to chart. On alternate days, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, they would take us to a blood lab. They would tie both of my arms to restrict the blood flow, take a lot of blood from my left arm, and give me a minimum of 5 injections in the right arm. The content of those injections, we didn't know then, nor do we know today. After one of those injections, I became very ill with a very high fever. My legs and arms were swollen and very painful. I was trembling as the August sun was burning my skin, and I had huge red spots covering my body. The next visit to the blood lab, they didn't tie my arms. Instead of that, measure my fever. And I was immediately taken to the hospital. The hospital was another barrack, but it was filled with people who looked to me more dead than alive. Next morning, Mengele came in with 4 other doctors, never ever examined me. He looked at my fever chart, and then he declared, "Too bad. She's so young. She has only 2 weeks to live." For the following 2 weeks, I have only one clear memory: crawling on the barrack floor because I no longer could walk, and crawling to reach a faucet with water at the other end of the barrack. And as I was crawling, I would fade out in and out of consciousness, telling myself, "I must survive, I must survive." After 2 weeks, my fever broke, and I felt immediately a lot stronger. It took me another 3 weeks before my fever chart showed normal. Miriam, when I got back, she was sitting on the bed, staring into space. When I asked her, "What happened to you?" she said, "I cannot talk about it. I will not talk about it." And we didn't talk about Auschwitz until 1985. And I asked her in 85, "Miriam, do you remember when I was taken to the hospital?" She said, "Yes." I said, "What happened to you while I was in the hospital?" She said, "I was under Nazi doctor supervision 24 hours a day. It was the same 2 weeks that Mengele said I would die." So I said to them, "What happened to you after the 2 weeks were up?" She said she was taken back to the labs injected with many injections that made her feel very sick. As we found out years later, when she grew up, got married in Israel, expected her first child, she developed severe kidney infections that did not respond to any antibiotic. Second pregnancy in 63, the infection got so bad that the Israeli doctor studied her, and they found out that Miriam's kidneys never grew larger than the size of a 10-year-old child. So I begged Miriam that not to have any more children, because every pregnancy was a life crisis. But she had a third child, and after the third child was born, her kidneys deteriorated, started to deteriorate, and by 1987, they failed, at which time I donated my left kidney. I had two kidneys and one sister, so it was an easy choice. But a year later, she developed cancerous polyps in the bladder. The doctors kept asking me to find our Auschwitz files. We never found our files. We never found out what was injected into our bodies. Miriam died June 6, 1993. Months after Miriam died, I received a telephone call from a professor at Boston who said he heard me speak and he would like me to go to Boston and speak. And when I came there, it would be nice if I could bring a Nazi doctor. I was stunned at such a question. And when I thought about it, I remembered that the last project that Miriam and I worked together before she died was 1992. And was a documentary done by a German television about the Mengele twins. And in that documentary, there was a Nazi doctor from Auschwitz. And I figured if he was alive in 92, he might be alive in 93. So I got his telephone number, I called him and invited him to Boston. But he told me he was not willing to go to Boston, but he was willing to meet with me at his house in Germany. And I didn't plan to ask him any of these questions. Suddenly, I am asking him, you were in Auschwitz. Did you ever walk by a gas chamber? Did you ever go inside the gas chamber? Do you know how the gas chamber operated? And he said, He said, this is the nightmare that I live with every single day of my life, and went on describing the operation of the gas chamber. He was stationed outside, looking through a peephole while the gas was coming down and people were dying. When everybody was dead and nobody moved, he knew that they were dead, and he signed one death certificate. No names, just the number of people that were murdered. And I asked him to go with me to Auschwitz in 1995, when we would observe 50 years to the liberation of the camp. Because I wanted him to sign a document, just what he told me, but I wanted it signed at the ruins of the gas chamber in Auschwitz. And he agreed immediately. I will have an original document signed by a Nazi. And if I ever met a revisionist who said the Holocaust didn't happen, I could take that document and shove it in their face. I wanted to thank this Nazi doctor for his willingness to document the gas chamber operation. I didn't know how to thank a Nazi. I didn't tell anybody about it because even to me it sounded strange. I didn't want anybody to change my mind. After 10 months, one morning I woke up and the following simple idea popped into my head. How about a letter of forgiveness from me to Dr. Munch? I knew immediately that he would like it, and that was a meaningful gift. A Auschwitz survivor gives him a letter of forgiveness to a Nazi doctor. But what I discovered for myself was life-changing. I discovered that I had the power to forgive. No one could give me that power. No one could take it away. It was all mine to use in any way I wished. And that became an interesting thing, because as a victim of almost 50 years, I never thought that I had any power over my life. Now, I began writing a letter, and I didn't know how to write a letter of forgiveness. And it took me 4 months to write it. And then I thought somebody might read it, and my diction in English is good, my spelling is not. So I wanted my former English professor to correct my spelling. So I called her. We met 3 times. And 3rd time she said to me, "Now, Eva, very nice, you forgive this Dr. Munch. Your problem is not with Dr. Munch. Your problem is with Dr. Mengele." I was not quite ready to forgive Mengele. She said to me, "Okay, I have been meeting with you, correcting your letters. Now I want you to do me a favor. When you go home tonight, pretend that Mengele is in the room and you are telling him that you forgive him. Because I want to find out how would it make you feel if you could do that." Interesting idea, I thought. And when I got home, actually, I did something else. I picked up a dictionary and wrote down 20 nasty words, which I read clear and loud to that make-believe Mengele in the room. And at the end, I said, "In spite of all that, I forgive you." Made me feel very good that I, the little guinea pig of 50 years, even had the power over the angel of death of Auschwitz. So that is the way we arrived in Auschwitz. Dr. Munch came with his son, daughter, and granddaughter. I took my son and my daughter. I read my declaration of amnesty, which is a very good little document. And I signed it. Dr. Munch signed his document. I felt free, free from Auschwitz, free from Mengele. So now that I have forgiven him, I knew that most of the survivors denounced me, and they denounce me today also. But what is my forgiveness? I like it. It is an act of self-healing, self-liberation, self-empowerment. All victims, all hurt, feel hopeless, feel helpless, feel powerless. I want everybody to remember that we cannot change what happened. That is the tragic part. But we can change how we relate to it.
Pretty powerful stuff. Thank you for sharing your heart, Amanda. Thank you for leading us in this good lesson on forgiveness. We always take up an offering. We have offering baskets over there. We need just a couple people. I haven't